It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air.
Well, we're up against the Super Bowl tonight. Hardly a recipe to miss the listenership. The saving factor is that one can listen to the show at a later date by simply going to the URL. The only thing lost is the ability to call in. The URLs for tonight's show and for other shows may be found at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. And you can also have links to my newspaper columns and to radio interviews and everything. My guest next week is historian Sally Cipher, PhD from Cornell University, college professor, town historian, councilwoman, and town supervisor at Putnam Valley, New York. Before beginning tonight's interview, I wish to take a moment to remember Pete Seeger.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn?
Pete was always out ahead of us, whether in protest against the strong-arm tactics of the House Un-American Activities Committee, segregation in the South, and in the North also, the Vietnam War, pollution in the Hudson River, and the Iraq War. His activities landed him in jail for 4 hours before his conviction was overturned. And he was blacklisted, and then all the way to the Presidential Medal of Freedom, to the General Electric cleanup of PCBs in the Hudson River, and his appearance with Bruce Springsteen at the Obama inauguration. He will be missed, but his many songs live on. My guest tonight, Marguerite Marie Rivas, has a doctorate in English and is a scholar, poet, college professor, fiction writer, and essayist. She is presently on sabbatical leave from the Borough of Manhattan Community College to conduct research related to the contemporary long poem and to write an analytical essay on William Carlos Williams's Patterson, and also on leave to do research on women in the American Southwest, leading to a book-length poem about women's relationship to geography of the American West in both the historical and the contemporary context. The latter project took her throughout the Southwest, including time on an archaeological dig site. We'll cover these points as well as other aspects of Marguerite's interesting life tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Marguerite, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, John.
Let's go back to the beginning. Where'd you grow up and go to grammar school and high school?
Well, I am a Staten Islander, born and bred. I'm actually widely known as the unofficial poet laureate of Staten Island. I grew up on Staten Island before there was a lot of development, before the Verrazano Narrows Bridge was built. So I had a beautiful, idyllic childhood, woods in my backyard, frozen ponds to skate on in the winter, wildflowers in the summer, and same with the overdevelopment of Staten Island that was somewhat lost. So I went to Catholic school on the South Shore of Staten Island, went to public school afterwards, and continued my education through the City University of New York. I have a master's degree specializing in British literature and a doctorate from Drew University, where I looked at American literature with emphasis on the long poem.
That's interesting. My guest next week, Sally Cipher, has her undergraduate degree in history concentrated on British history. When did you begin to write poetry?
I began to write poetry in 1992. Very interesting thing happened to me. I had studied poetry. I was an English undergrad major and an art history co-major, and then I had my master's degree. And so I was always able to enjoy and analyze poetry and understand it, but I never felt worthy enough of to be a poet. It was just something that, you know, I adored baseball players, and I always wanted to be a shortstop for the New York Mets, but I never figured I'd be good enough to pick up a bat. It was sort of the same way with poetry. Then one day I was sitting in a beautiful old church, gigantic church, listening to a St. John's Passion in German. There was a choir that was performing this, and my sister was actually one of the singers. And I was sitting there, and all of a sudden, I was assailed by images that I had no idea where they were coming from or what they meant. So I nudged my dad, who was always one to have a pen in his pocket, and took his pen and just started dictating as though it were automatic writing the images that were coming out of listening to this music on the program. And when I got home that night, I had two small children at the time, I put them to bed, and I cracked open a beer, and I just started writing down what the images were. And I looked at it, and I realized that they were images related to a pregnancy loss that I had had, and something that I hadn't thought about nor had I ever written about. And I shaped it into a poem, and that was my first poem.
I know that you began your academic climb with an associate's degree. Had you planned all the time to continue your pursuit all the way to the top, or did that come about as you went along?
It sort of came about as I went along. I always, it's funny, my students ask me, you know, I teach at a community college, and sometimes students feel as though that's second best, or especially if they major in liberal arts, something that's not going to be immediately applied. And I try to instill in them that you start off somewhere, but you never can imagine where you're going to end up. And I think a liberal arts education is one of the best things that you can start off with. So when I started as a Staten Island Community College student, I think the seeds were there. I was always a creative person. I enjoyed photography, and I was kind of a daydreamer. But I never imagined that I would finally get to the point where I would be holding I would be called doctor. But I just kept plugging along. And at different points in my life, things happened to me that made me change the direction that my life took dramatically. And
It's interesting that you mentioned the liberal arts. I was an English major, and I spent the majority of my working life as a technologist, because I was in the right place at the right time. But with the way the economy is and the pressure on young people, more and more people, both businesses and young people, they want to turn college into almost a trade school, preparing students for jobs. And I can understand the pressure, but that scares me. When I went to school, we went to school to get an education, and I wasn't quite sure what I was going to be. But I think we've lost a lot of that. I see that in my own teaching. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with you. I feel as though there's a lot of pressure on young people to know what they're going to be and to be that thing. And I think it's really interesting. I have two daughters, one who is 26 and the other is 24. And the 26-year-old, she went away to college and she studied theater. She was very gifted in acting. It's something that runs in my family. And there was a point in her education where she called me up and she said, "Mom, I think I need to go into nursing." And now this is not a kid who is at all adept in that. Let me just say that neither of my children are. And I asked her why she wanted to switch to nursing, and she said that she was afraid that her father was putting pressure on her to do something that had value, that he considered to have value. And I simply said to her, what do you wish to do, number one, and secondly, who's paying for your education, not your dad? So and she said, I want to be a theater major. And I said, great. I don't want you to go into something because you think you need a job at it or something that you're not going to be happy in. There are many people who are happy in the medical field. I didn't think she was one of them. But the other thing was, she came out of that, and I had so many friends whose kids were majoring in business and these really real-world application, as they saw it, majors. And I said, no, I want my kid to be able to come out of school, to be able to think creatively, to problem solve, to speak well, and to be able to read and write. And if you have those skills, there isn't anything you really can't learn. And sure enough, that's what happened. And she's got a wonderful job. She's well employed. And I'm very, very proud of her and happy at what she did. So I try to instill this in my students as well. You know, for the love of learning, it sounds sort of like an idealistic, hippy-dippy thing, but it's always borne out for me to be true in my own life, in the life of my children.
And the most important thing, the way the technology is changing everything, is to be adaptable, because the job that mm-hmm. you get when you graduate may not exist in 4 years, and the job you may wind up doing for 15 may also not exist when you're going into the marketplace. So it's a big change that you have to all – it's lifetime learning, but that's the important thing. But you always have
to be
looking over your shoulder saying – what comes next? When did you publish your first poetry? Was it the first poem, or was it after that?
What was my first poem?
No, you mentioned when you wrote your first poem, but when did you publish your first poetry? Was it your first poem, or was it later?
My first poem was very shortly thereafter. What happened was these same two young women were little girls, and I was going to school at night, and I was teaching as an adjunct at night, and I had very little time to write, and I was taking care of my children during the day, and one day I was with them, they were coloring, and again, there were moments that I was able to just grab for myself, and I wrote my first published poem was with one of them crawling up my back trying to pull the headphones off my ears as I was listening to an old standard. I was listening to Skylark, I remember, and they were fighting over crayons, and I grabbed one of the crayons and I started scrawling the words in the book, in the coloring book, and I sent it to this Association of Mothers. It was like a mother center, and they had a newsletter, and they published my poem, and they were the first people to publish my poem. They were an organization of mothers.
I know that you've also published a staggering amount of academic research. Please tell us about some of your literary interests.
Well, I have... My literary interests are mostly around poetry and including teaching students how to experience the world in order to render it in writing, whether it be poetry or essays. And I especially interested in the poetry of a poet named Martina Spada, who I've been following since his early career as well. And he's an incredibly wonderful poet whose themes are mostly around issues of working people, of, the political poems. There are beautiful poems that really illuminate the lives of the people who are in the dark corners who we don't see. And so that's, one of my interests is Latino poetry of the U.S., and mostly Martina Spada is one of my favorite poets I write about. And, I've also done research and writing about William Carlos Williams and other poets.
I know that one of your papers that relates to this was entitled Edwin Markham, Poet Laureate of Labor. Markham isn't well known to the general public. Would you tell us something about him?
Sure. Edwin Markham was he wrote a poem called The Man with the Hoe, and he was part of the progressive movement, and this poem was, there was a time when poetry was printed in the newspapers. People don't realize this. They could open their daily newspaper and see a poem. They could open their daily newspaper and see a poem by Poe or Whitman or Edwin Markham. And Markham moved from California, Lincoln, California, where he lived, to Staten Island. And he lived for a good deal of his adult working life on Staten Island. So that article was actually picked up by the an encyclopedia of the Golden of the Gilded Age and Progressive Era. And again, his Man with the Hoe did what today Martina Spada's work does in illuminating those working people whose lives are not heralded, whose lives are not examined. And that
what
was
period,
one of the
What period did Markham write in?
Markham wrote in the early part of the 20th century, and that was sort of his kind of golden age himself of writing. He wrote that. He wrote a poem called Lincoln, Man of the People, there were other Staten Island writers as well whose names people would not know, but who were very famous in their time, as Markham was. And I recently received a grant, last year I received a grant to do research and writing on two women writers who were also prolific and famous in their time and who sort of have fallen by the wayside as well.
That was my next question about the research that you did under the New York State Council for the Arts and Staten Island
mm-hmm.
Council on women literary history in Staten Island. Did it focus just on those two, or was there a wider range of other women that had
Are other women that I'm planning on making. These two were the first women in a series of women writers on Staten Island that I'm going to hopefully at some point turn to. But this one particular writer, her name was Florence Morse Kingsley, and it's not a name you would recognize at all, but she's probably the most prolific Staten Island writer except for Paul Vindel, whose name you might have heard. He was he wrote a play called Effective Gamma Rays on Men and the Moon, Marigolds, and The Pig Man, which are kind of famous. But she had a book that she wrote, and some of her books were religious themes. Most of them were these sort of little romance kind of domestic books, but embedded in these books were really interesting characters. So we're looking at a book that was, say, published in 1914, And the heroine of the book is actually going to graduate school for psychology. It's just remarkable. And this woman had one book that was translated into 19 languages. And in my research, I found her at Mark Twain's birthday dinner I found a program for Mark Twain's birthday dinner, and she was listed on the dais with Mark Twain, Helen Keller. I mean, that's how famous she was.
Wow.
But as taste changed and as, you know, things changed post-World War One, it wasn't, you know, she wasn't, she didn't, her name was not put forward in the pantheon of writers. However, she co-authored a book with Mary E. Wilkins Freeman, who is an important American writer, and some of her films, some of her books were turned into films in the early days of Hollywood, in the infancy of Hollywood.
Now, you mentioned, and I just thought of this, Staten Island and religious themes. Did any of your research, would Dorothy Day have been included under that, or was it the fact that she didn't do much poetry precluded
her? No. Dorothy Day is for the is for the future projects. I have two or three other writers that I'm going to be looking at. You know, I envision this as part of a series on women authors, and one of them is Dorothy Day. I'll be writing about when I'm going to do two 20th century women authors.
Okay.
Not necessarily just poets, but Dorothy Day would. There's a lot been written on Dorothy Day. I'm also kind of about trying to find those women who've been lost to history, and perhaps minor roles in major movements, that kind of thing.
I understand. Moving to your own poetry, I first met you when you were publishing some original work on MySpace. What led you to writing on social media when you had already published a good deal through traditional printed sources?
Wow, it's really interesting you say that, because I was just flipping through some of my pages that I printed out from the internet, and I looked at the MySpace poems, and I thought, gee, that was really, pre-Facebook days. I think just the desire to be read by a number of people, and to be read by people who might not normally read poetry. And I had found that to be true over the years, that the things that I'd put on social media had sometimes gotten, has been picked up by people, and I've actually gotten one or two publications from that, and by people who just have read it and enjoyed it, who are not necessarily poets, who might be musicians, the general public, writers. I have made acquaintance, I feel, with poets all over the world. There are two poets in Northern Ireland whose work I admire and who found me via social media. So it's kind of interesting.
Working backwards a little, I see the poem Pilgrimage from your 2012 book, Tell No One Poems of Witness, that has just been selected for inclusion in Toccata's literature anthology due out next month. Would you mind reading it for us?
Oh, sure. I'd love to read it. It's interesting. Some of my poems, I look at some of the themes in my poems, and a lot of them have to do with family, have to do with being a mother or a daughter, and some of them have to do with ancestry. And I have this wonderful Irish name, Marguerite Maria Rivas, when indeed my mom was Irish. So it was a good part of my family that hails from Ireland. And I recently found some of my grandmother's siblings' descendants. Really very interesting. But Pilgrimage is a poem that is coming out next month in the college anthology, and I'm very excited about it. And I'll read it to you and the folks. Pilgrimage. Our ancestors scraped the ground and cursed the blackened potato, then ate the dirt and left the dead by the emerald roadside, too weary for obligation, too starved and numb for keening, dragged leaden feet to the coast, and coffined their way to a place where they deposited us, hopeful seeds of sorrow and starvation's progeny. For what? For us to discover that love was an empty well where dreams lay waste at the dry bottom? No. Despite the bent back, the work-calloused hands, and the burden of crying babies slung on the working hip, we dream of holy wells, where reflections of the past and visions of the future sustain us on the journey begun beside a white thorn tree and a low stone fence over a century ago.
My four grandparents came from Ireland before the turn of the 20th century. And in thinking back, just they didn't know each other. They were all young. That must have taken some courage to leave the land that you knew and to get on these death trap boats and to come over here to a new land. God.
It's staggering to think. To think about it, my grandmother was the 13th of 13 children. 13 children, can you imagine? And half of her siblings were left in Ireland to be brought back over, and they never came over because their father died, and my grandmother's mother remarried. So there were siblings that my grandmother never even met.
I had a my grandmother and her sister and perhaps her brother were here, and they were sending money back to Ireland for a younger sister, Bridget, who wanted to come. And at some point, there was almost enough money, and the oldest sister, Mary, took the money, bought a cow, and sold milk until the following spring. She sold the cow, and she got on the boat. She said, I'm the eldest. I'm going to America. Bridget never made it, but I danced with my Aunt Mary when she was 96 at her grandniece's wedding.
Isn't that wonderful? Poor Bridget. Well, who knows, right?
Right.
Who knows what their lives would be like?
What is the process like for inclusion in such a book? Did you submit, or did they just find you?
They kind of found me, and one of the editors, asked me if I would like to submit for consideration, just a few poems, and I did, and I was shocked to find that it was chosen. They were looking for new work that had some symbolic content to it, and authors who hadn't really, were new authors. And even though I'm not a young person, I'm fairly new at this. So, I'm a minor poet. I'm as minor as they get.
You may consider yourself a minor poet, but you mentioned to me that your work is going to be between Mary Rukeyser and Walt Whitman.
Yeah,
that's pretty major stuff.
Oh, it's the most major thing that's ever happened to me. It'll probably be, it will definitely be the most I'll be read by any, I think they said it was the second best-selling college literature anthology. So I'm really excited by the fact that I'm going to be read by people. I mean, that's really, poets, we don't go into this business, and you you're a writer yourself. You don't go into the business thinking that you're going to make a lot of money out of it. It's something that you do because you must, I feel. At least that's how I feel. I felt like poetry chose me. And it's not something. It's not something that I just have to do it. It's just something that has to be done, and it's really exciting.
I agree with you completely. When people ask me about writing, I say that my columns are because I know something I want you to know. My fiction is because I want to tell you a story, But my poetry is written for me, and I hope people like it. But if they don't, so what? You know, it's what I do, and I as I mentioned, I was an English major, but then I went into technology, and I hadn't read, never mind written, a poem for 30 years, and I was just passing through a poetry section in Barnes & Noble, and I saw a book by Charles Bukowski with a weird title, and I said, well, let me look at that. And then I said, well, he's crazy. I could do that. And then I wound up winning one of these contests with the first poem that I wrote, and unfortunately, or fortunately, that started me off. I noticed that one of your poems is an audio version. How did that come about?
I'm trying to think of which poem. I have several poems. Oh, it was made into an audio CD. One of my poems was set to music by a composer who I also do improvisational poetry, jams with musicians. I have some musicians who I work with regularly, and one of them's name is Doug Principato. He's a musician. He's a composer. And he took one of my poems and set it to music, and it was released in his CD last year called Calling the Air. And it was a poem that I wrote for my firstborn. I had a daughter in 1982. Her name was Maria, and she was born with birth defects, and she died shortly after she was born. And that was one of those life-changing events that changed the whole course of your thinking and what's important to you in your life. I was just a young girl myself, and when I think back on it, it's kind of amazing that so much time has passed, and I was so young. I was 25, I think. And that poem is extraordinarily important to me. And we were talking about music and memorializing people in music, and I said to him, you know, how important that particular poem was to me, and he took it and he set it to music, and he did a beautiful job of it, just an amazing job, and he has such a wonderful voice, and I'm very honored that he did that.
That's a poignant story. Are you also have poems in museum collections? What is that process?
I have some poems that I wrote and that I actually have that someone videotaped of. I won an award with one of the poems called Witness. It's a poem about 9/11. And the College English Association awarded me a poem. They have an April Poetry Month kind of award every year, and I won an award for that. And the if you go on to the September 11th Memorial Museum, you can submit artwork and poetry to that venue, and they will, I guess, accept or reject it. So I've got some poems there, as well as, I believe, a videotape of my reading of one that was videotaped by photographer Willie Chu. So that's, you know, that's there. And the poem Witness is, again, another very important poem for me in terms of being a Staten Islander. That poem was picked up in Puerto Rico. There's a newspaper and a media outlet in Puerto Rico somehow got a hold of that poem, they came and they interviewed me for 9/11, for the 10th anniversary of 9/11, based on finding that poem, actually talking about media online. I guess they found it on that website.
That's another honor, in addition to the textbook and everything. I know that some of the poems in your 2012 book that I mentioned earlier tell no one, poems of witness, are very short and punchy. Yet one of your two projects on leave has been on the long poem, and
mm-hmm.
you are writing one. Would you tell us about first the project and second why did you choose the long poem form for this work?
Sure. It's ironic. You know, I wear three different poetic hats. One of them is that I write lyric poetry. I write these short poems, which, you know, in this day and age of publishing, you know, the amount of space one, the amount of ink and the amount of bandwidth one gets in journals is not very big. So, you know, the long poem is not one that you're going to see published and consumed as much, I suppose, as the short poem. But I wrote for my doctoral dissertation, I did work on a long poem that I looked at the form and the way that, mostly because after reading William Carlos Williams Patterson, I was really, I love to write poetry of place, and Williams' long poem is so embedded in that place. So I sought to write a poem myself, a long poem, an epic that was, that wove history and tradition and folklore together in a sort of epic form that was new. And so I said to myself, one day I'm going to get back to looking at Williams again and looking at other practitioners of the long poem form. I really enjoy reading long poems, and there are so many varieties of long poems, especially modern long poems, critic Lynn Keller, who writes about the long poem, calls it the genre that is not one, because there are so many varieties, verse novels and collage-type poems and linked poems. So I was lucky to have this sabbatical time to devote this whole year to the first part of the year being the study of the long poem in a critical way, and the second part of the year will be composing my own long poem based on my own historical research.
Staying on your projects on your leave, please tell us about the southwestern USA. How did you get interested in it, and what made you, as you described it, a boots-on-the-ground research?
It's a boots-on-the-ground research. Well, I'm a person who likes to go to the place, feel what it's like to be in the place, and that's how I've always written my poetry. My long poem, which was about Staten Island, which is rooted in actual earth, like just going to the middle of the woods and, you know, putting my head down on a rock and looking up and just being there. So I said to myself, what is it like to go from something that's so contained, like an eastern city, like an island? You know, in my long poem, my long poem I wrote years ago, the island is the person, it is the demigoddess, and what's it like to go from there to something boundless, to boundless space? And in about 10 years ago, I was lucky enough to have received a scholarship from a Room of Her Own Foundation, which had just started to support women writers, and they had a residency of sorts of a women's writers retreat every 2 years at Ghost Ranch in northern New Mexico, which is where Georgia O'Keeffe lived. I mean, literally on the grounds of Ghost Ranch. And I remember going there for the first time after 9/11. It was just such a wonderful experience to be able to look at a blue sky and not be afraid, to be able to look and not see a building anywhere. That I started to think about when I'm going to write my, you know, I'm going to write my next book. I want to wonder what it was like for women to have experienced that, from going from the east to the west before me, women before me. And I thought, well, who would I look at? And then it came to me that officers' wives would have been and children would have traveled from eastern cities to western forts at the frontier, like Fort Leavenworth and Fort Union in New Mexico, and that's where I went. So this summer, I was lucky enough to go to Ghost Ranch again, where I discovered that my poem was not going to be just about women who went from the east to the west, but from women whose lives sprung from that area. And it was just such a wonderful experience. I was able to go with an anthropologist to a dig site to look at some of the early, the ancient people who lived in the area, specifically the Guyana people. And I started to write about, you know, things historical, but being there was important. How can you write about the shade of the color of the morning sun off a mesa if you have never seen it? And that's what I needed to spend time in the desert. What was the light like in the desert? How can I imagine what a woman going to Fort Union, for example, from New York City, what was it like for her to see in the middle of nowhere, this desolate place, this little fort, amazing things. You know, the rain, the endless rain, the prairie dogs. I mean, what was it like for them? What were their lives like? And so it was one thing for me to go. I actually was able to go to where the records were held at New Mexico Highlands University and spend time there and actually go to the ruins of the fort itself, which is now a national monument. And I'm so lucky to have been able to have that experience. And now I'm going to be writing about it for the coming year.
You also mentioned to me earlier that you're going to go back this year. Are you going to the same place?
I am probably going to be going back to the same place, yep. And I want to, after having written about it and looking at what I've written, revisit. I'm going to be revisiting some places and looking at my research again. So I'm hoping to do that. I'm hoping to do that sometime this spring.
You mentioned the Southwest. Have you ever been to Tombstone, Arizona?
No, I have not.
That's one of my favorite places that I've ever been. It's up in the mountains, even though it's south of Tucson, about 90 miles, and it's cooler than either Tucson or Phoenix. And there's such, I mean, they've tried to preserve it, but there's so much history there that's very interesting. I walked through Boot Hill, and I'm told that this was authentic. There was a tombstone. Here lies Joseph Smith, hang by mistake, things like that.
Oh, my gosh.
Which are very interesting, you know. The only really long poems other than the Williams poem that I can think of are Allen Ginsberg's, and also one that was published about a year ago, and I have it, and I can't place the title. It's by a very well-known woman poet, and it relates to her brother, and it's a couple of hundred pages all together in a fan fold in a book. I wish I could think of the name of it.
I don't know it. I don't know it.
Just the way I'll send you an email after on it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have another poem that you'd like to read?
Oh, sure. Let me see. I have a poem that I wrote about. This is an early poem. I guess I wrote it in the mid '90s. I remember looking at a picture in the New York Times. They had found a almost completely intact body of an ancient Peruvian woman on the top of a mountain, and what happened was that her face was exposed, but everything else was completely intact, she was dubbed the Peruvian Ice Princess, and I looked at her face, and that other part of my heritage is Peruvian, and I looked at that face, and I thought, wow, I mean, this could be an ancient ancestor, and here's her face on the front of the New York Times, just looking at me, and the way the scientists were talking about this human life was as though she were an artifact. And so I wrote this poem. It's called Reading the New York Times, Move Over, Iceman of Europe, the Peruvian Ice Woman Cometh. Her face looks like pottery that has fallen off the wheel, covered and shrouded in fine textiles, wrapped lovingly, virgin sacrifice to the mountain, whose wrath the people knew, floods, avalanche, starvation. Protruding from the snow, tiny red feathers fanned by the Andean wind, eager anthropologists knew the find was real. Centuries of ice relinquish Inca treasure, statues of a raving god, cloth woven by the honored family, imprinted with the Inca key, breath, moon, sun, life, Viracocha, becomes the death mantle of the Inca daughter, bride of the god, daughter of the ice, lover of the Andes. Head bowed, she kneels in the snow, a relief from the wind, sky, and white blaze, and priests with a cudgel and her mother's woven mantle, and a vision of the god, golden rod sinking slowly into barren land. It is done. Her spirit, white as the snow of her sepulcher, honored offering to an unyielding god who one day yields to men of science. They chisel her from the bosom of the god, hoist her across their shoulders, strap her to the back of a burro, load her onto a train where she is loot. Such a find, she wasn't freeze-dried like the others. Organs perfectly preserved. We'll harvest DNA from this one, if only her face were not exposed. And I, her kinswoman, read, study the photographs, and think that her face looks like pottery that has fallen off the wheel.
I like that. As you were reading it, I was thinking of making relations to two previous poets, both women that I've had on the show. Amy Holman was on 2 weeks ago.
Oh,
gets many of her poems from reading the newspaper, and they're very often quirky and funny, but it's her take on things she's read in the paper. Mm-hmm. And I had Judith Kerman on about a month and a half ago, and she's the owner of Mayapple Press, which is a publishing house out of Woodstock, New York, and she publishes a lot of women poets, and she also herself does translations of Spanish poetry of a Cuban poet whose name escapes me that she's very interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So that all seems to come together, the newspaper and the publishing and everything. I find it very interesting.
It's kind of interesting where the sources of creative output, you know, what are your sources, you know, newspapers or just something that strikes you that resonates with you that will hopefully resonate with someone else.
Yeah, I had that first thing. What kicked me off was I was reading a motorcycle magazine, and the end there was a quote that the brain writes checks that the body can't cash. Then that kicked me into my first poem. So very interesting. Other than mentioning that you're sabbatical, the glossed over the college teaching you've been doing for 25 years, first at the College of Staten Island and mm-hmm. the Manhattan Community College. What do you teach, and had you always wanted to teach at the higher ed level?
I had, you know, I started out, I had a very interesting work career. I started out working at the Metropolitan Museum of Art right out of college, as in the sculpture shop as a sales assistant, and it paid so poorly I couldn't even afford to go to work. And then I worked for Dreyfus Corporation. I mean, this is where your reading and writing and able to analyze text come in. I ended up being a mutual fund salesperson and also a training director at one point. And then, my life changed. What's
was that when Dreyfus was in Tube Broadway?
Dreyfus was on Madison Avenue and the GM building in Midtown at that point.
Okay. They had an office, or they cleared from Wurtschlager and Cameron when I worked in the same building. Their clearing firm was in Tube Broadway.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Right off the ferry. Uh-huh.
And then how did you get into teaching from
Dreyfus? So here's the thing. Here's an interesting thing that happened. When I was sort of promoted to training director, actually, I was training people who had business degrees on how to basically be account executives, answer the phones, answer questions, you know, like a call-in bank. And I enjoyed that part of the job. I found I could teach people things. I could teach people things who, in kind of different ways, like creative ways. And then I had my baby, Maria, who died. And that changed my life. And I said, wait a minute, what am I going to be doing with the rest of my life here? Am I going to be helping a corporation make a lot of money, or do I want to use this talent that I think that I now have to work with children? And the answer was that I wanted to work with children. So I went back to school again and got the credits for to teach grammar school. And then I started teaching second and third grade and seventh and eighth grade. And then I realized that that was not what I wanted at all. Although I enjoyed it, it was tiring. It just wasn't. It wasn't what I felt like I needed to do. And I went back for my master's degree, and I was offered, you know, sort of like a teaching fellowship kind of thing as an adjunct. And then I realized that that was what I meant to do, was to teach in higher ed. And I taught as an adjunct for 15 years while I went to school for my master's and then my doctorate, and I raised my kids. And now I'm a tenured professor at Borough Manhattan Community College. So I really do enjoy working with college students.
It's interesting. I feel the same way how you work into this. I was a technologist for over 30 years, and college teaching began as the way to give back my knowledge. But
mm-hmm.
I moved into full-time teaching for 10 years, and I loved it. Now I adjunct at SUNY Purchase, and I still love it. And the adjuncting provides me time for my writing, my newspaper column, and this radio show, which, by the way, takes more preparation time than broadcast time. But I love it all. Which of the many things that you do gives you the biggest kick?
In terms of teaching or?
In terms of the writing, the research, the essays, the poetry, to what gives you the biggest high? Do you know?
Yeah, I do. The research. The actual in situ research, going to a place, walking in the footsteps of the people that I've read about in the archives, and also spending time in the archives. I love the research. I love the research, and I have to be careful about it because I met some wonderful writers this summer. Including the author Janet Fitch, who wrote White Oleander. And she talked about researching for writing. And she said, don't get lost. The research, she said this to me, the research has to be the wallpaper to the thing that you write. You know, unless, of course, you're writing an article about, you know, an historical article. And I thought to myself, lost in that research and not remember that that's the back for what's human in the piece of writing.
Yeah,
so,
go ahead.
So I guess if the writing, the research, You know, I'm not counting the teaching. Those things are what excite me the most about my job as a writer. And in terms of my life, my whole entire life, the thing that is most meaningful to me is being a mother. There's nothing more meaningful to me than having reared my two beautiful children and still nurturing them today. I have a daughter who's a college student who still went back to school after realizing, you know, that's what she, you know, took her some time to realize that's what she wanted to do. And but being a mom has been the most important thing in my life and informs my work, I think, as a mother, as a woman. My work is informed by my experience. Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, and then in conjunction with what you were doing at Dreyfus. When I was in the corporate world, everything I really enjoyed what I was doing. And technology, you worked these 70-hour weeks, and you worked weekends. And the society keeps you thinking that everything that you do is important. And to me, it was very important at the time. But after you do something else, you step back and you say, well, in 100 years, the history books, they may have the wars, they may have the civil rights movement, but they're not going to have a terrific payroll system that I put in for some brokerage firm. You know, that's not going to make it. So if it's not going to be of any lasting value, perhaps you should be doing things that are important to you for your life, you know, and that's a different way of looking at things. Is there anything else that you'd like the audience to know about Marguerite Marie Rose?
Well, I'm going to be coming out with an e-book. I might as well plug something.
Sure. Sure, go ahead.
I have an ebook forthcoming. I'm not exactly sure if it's going to be an ebook of collected poems that did not make it into my book that was published last in 2012. It's funny, I had this wonderful book published by this lovely small press, and people would come up to me and they'd say they would I had a poem called Pay at the Pump, which is sort of another poem written on the back of with a crayon when my kids were little, and I sort of became famous for this poem, and people would come running up to me after they get their book as though they were cheated, and they'd say, "Where's Pay at the Pump?" Or someone else would name another poem that was their favorite poem that wasn't in the book. So I'm going to be coming out with an e-book. It's going to be published by Villa Florentine Press, and I'm sure when, but it'll be by the end of, by the time the spring, time flowers bloom, it should be out. So that should be interesting.
That's terrific. I put my collected poems up on as a Kindle book, and that gets moderate sales, but it was interesting. It was something to do, you know.
Well, and it's also a way for people to find you. You know, you know, people can purchase my book at different outlets on Staten Island. It's not wholly distributed, or at my readings, but like social media, I think e-publishing is a great idea because, you know, someone in Northern Ireland can hear you on the radio and go find your book on Kindle. And I think that's where the future is going. You know, I still love my paper books, but I like the idea that people can just read your book and download it and hear you and say, I think I want to hear more. So,
do you have a website that people can go to, Marguerite?
I do. It is it's my name. It's I believe it's Marguerite Maria Rivas.com. But if you Google my name, you can come up with it.
And would you spell Marguerite for the people that aren't familiar with spelling?
It's Marguerite. My middle name is Rivas, Rivas. Oh, wait, my last name is Rivas. My middle name is Maria. So if you Google Marguerite Maria Rivas, you should find my website fairly easily. Oh, look at me. I tried to look it up, and here you are. Okay, so yeah, that should be it. You should be able to find it that way. You can find me on Facebook. I also have an author page on Facebook. And I link up to my website on there, too.
Well, tonight's been a real pleasure for me, Marguerite. Do you have one more poem? Would you have one more poem to take us to the wrap-up, to my wrap-up?
Yes, I do. I have a poem that I would really love to read. And it is a poem that I wrote at a very dark time where I thought, as a single mom and in a very bad place, and I said to myself, I thought about my grandmother and her mom, and how did they do this? And I said, if I were in Ireland, I'd probably just rest myself down and just not get up again. And then some years later, I was happy to find the descendants, my grandmother's family. And so I rewrote this poem to make it a little less depressing. But my great-grandmother's name was Annie McGaldridge, and I imagined what her life was like after she gave birth to my grandmother. And I dedicated this poem to my family, and especially my Aunt Gloria, who encouraged me and without whom I would probably not be speaking to you right now. So this is called, and I'd like to end with this for my cousins, my girl cousins, The Lullaby of Annie McGaldridge After the Birth of Her 13th Child. If I were in Ireland now, I'd rest in a peat bog, close my eyes, and let it take me down to nothingness, no weariness, no sorrow, no hunger. Below tufts of purpling heather, I'd be Ballymoney turf and welcome soft oblivion, home, and now home again. Still, I'm sure a century from now, some faithful Irish poet, one who shares my blood, would bid her sisters take up their slants, cut me out and lift me up, rest me gently beneath the sun to dry, and carry me home once more. And these faithful Irish women, ones who share my blood, would place me in the fire where I'd warm them and illuminate their faces and their souls as their laughter banishes sorrow. And there, as blue smoke rises, a searching Irish poet, one who shares my blood, would sit serenely at my hearth and spy me in the flames as the lovesome breath of poetry and the faithful Irish women bring me home to Glengad again.
That's terrific. Is that any place that I can find it to have a copy of?
That is in my... that is actually on a website called Stage... it was on a website called stageandscreenwriters.com. And it's also in my book, Tell No One Poems of Witness, and it I think you can find that online. You can probably find that online.
Okay.
And it will be coming, it will be included in my collected poems, my ebook that's forthcoming.
That's terrific. Well, once again, thank you very much, Marguerite.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate it. I had a lot of fun speaking with you tonight, and I just thank you so much for doing this. It was a pleasure, such a pleasure.
Great. And the words of the Mets radio announcer, Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Tune in next week for my conversation with historian and public person, Sally Cipher. And until then, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Steady, Silver.